This is Radio Boston. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. On our show today, we'll be bringing you some of our favorite author interviews from this past year. We'll talk about the gritty crime novels of Dennis Lehane, we'll tour the strange world of a prison library, and we'll finish with an updated portrait of American prep. To start off, let's listen to this clip from the movie Gone, Baby, Gone.
I just want my daughter back. I swear to God, I won't do no drugs no more. I won't even go out if you drink across my heart.
It's all right, we're gonna find her, Ellie.
You have to promise.
The movie stars Casey Affleck as Detective Patrick Kenzie. Kenzie has the grim job of finding a missing 4-year-old named Amanda McCready. Amanda was actually kidnapped by a family member who thought she was in danger. In the end, Kenzie is forced to make a tough decision, whether or not to return the child to her drug-addicted mother. Gone, Baby, Gone was written by Dennis Lehane, who this year came out with a new book, Moonlight Mile. The new book starts 12 years after Gone, Baby, Gone left off. Here's Dennis Lehane reading a passage from that book. Detective Kenzie has just run into the only woman who's ever cared about Amanda McCready, Amanda's Aunt Beatrice.
12 years ago, Amanda McCready had been kidnapped by her Uncle Lionel and some rogue cops who'd had no interest in ransoming or hurting her. What they'd wanted was to put that child in a home with a mother who didn't drink like she owned stock in London Gin or pick her boy toys from the sex freak shopping network. When I found Amanda, she was living with a couple who loved her. They'd been determined to give her health, stability, and happiness. Instead, they'd gone to prison, and Amanda had been returned to Helene's home by me. Beatrice said, "You owe, Patrick." "What?" I said, "You owe."
So Amanda McCready, who was 4 years old when she was returned to her mother after having been kidnapped.
Yep.
In Gone, Baby, Gone.
Yes.
Is now 16 and missing again.
Yes.
When I realized what your new book was about, it reminded me of that sick feeling I had at the end of Gone, Baby, Gone, because you think, you're returning this kid to this house?
Mm-hmm.
Did you intentionally leave Gone, Baby, Gone hanging like that, thinking, I want to write a sequel, or maybe it will give me the option to write a sequel?
No, that was never the intention. The intention was really clearly that I felt we, as a society, have not remotely dealt with a lot of issues in terms of parenting and how we deal with the issue of nature versus nurture, the issue of biological parents versus better parents in a lot of cases. And so I said, since the issue has not been dealt with by society, I'm not going to sew it up in a book, because that would be disingenuous. And also, how do you feel on the issue? I mean, yes, in the particular of the Amanda McCready case and Gone, Baby, Gone, nobody would want her to leave the people she was with to go back to the neglectful mother she was from.
Because she was in a good, stable home,
yes.
Even though she had been kidnapped to be put in that home.
To be put in that home. But then, do we want to build a society around the principle that if somebody, anybody, decides they don't like how somebody is raising their child, they get to take them? And so that was the larger question.
So in Moonlight Mile, we again have the private investigative duo Patrick Kenzie and Angela Gennaro.
Yep.
Patrick is tortured, maybe too strong a word, but he's really wrestling with whether he made the right decision, the right moral decision, to return this child to this neglectful, broken home.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you wanted the book to do a lot, have Patrick wrestling with a decision from long ago?
I think one of the biggest myths we've been sold, and I blame Oprah, is we've been sold this myth that there's such a thing as closure. And if you just get your head around things and you wrap it all up and you put it all in a nice ball and tie a ribbon off on it, then everything will be fine and you'll be able to move on. And I think there's certain things in our lives we never move on from and we never get closure on. And this is one of those things. Because what he says, a refrain in the book over and over, it's not just what he says or he thinks, it's what people say to him. You were right. And then there's a beat, but you were wrong. You were right, but you were wrong. You were wrong, but you were right. And so he's made this decision that is impossible to live with on some levels.
This theme of parenting and the impact that mm-hmm. poor parenting can have on a child's life is an undercurrent in this book. Now,
yeah.
I think the obvious question is, you have a 15-month-old daughter now.
Yeah.
Did having a child for the first time make you suddenly want to write about these issues because you're newly aware of these issues?
No. I was always aware of these issues, which is why it took so long to become a parent. I had worked with kids from broken homes. I'd worked with abused kids. I'd worked with kids who were neglected. I'd worked with kids who were savagely abused. I mean, I ran the gamut. So I'd always been interested in it, and I was always very careful about having a child because I was very aware of the weight of it. Or I thought I was. Then I had one, And then I was like, oh, wow, you didn't even have a clue. And you were pretty bad, you know?
bad as a kid.
No, I mean pretty bad in terms of what you were pretty, I was pretty aware of the responsibilities of parenting. As much as a non-parent could be. And then all of a sudden I stepped into it, and you just have no, there's a moment where Patrick talks about how you live with the burden of it from that point on, the burden of your own love. The moment you become a parent, you have ceded any illusions you ever had of being self-sufficient, self-sustaining, an entity unto yourself. That is over. And so I think that began to enter into the book in a way that I didn't know, you know, that it would. Until, you know, I think there's a scene early where they're sitting and they're talking and they can hear their daughter breathing in the room. And he reflects on what that means and the incredible weight of that as to love something that much. And I was like, no, I probably wouldn't have written that line a year and a half ago. But now it's, you know, it's second nature.
Many of your stories are obviously rich with the city of Boston.
Yeah.
I think in just the first few pages, let alone the first few chapters of your new book, Moonlight Mile, you reference Neptune Oyster and mm-hmm. then North End. You reference International Place. You reference Boston College. Let's talk about your own life and how it influences your view of Boston, because you mm-hmm. are a Boston guy. You grew
yeah.
up in Dorchester.
In Dorchester, yeah.
Later lived in West Roxbury.
I've lived everywhere. I've gotten most of the zip codes, as long as they're in the 021. I've lived in Brighton. I've lived in Southie. I've lived in Charlestown. I've lived in Fenway. I've lived in Cambridgeport, which I consider sort of Boston. It's the one part of Cambridge that's very Boston, Cambridgeport.
It used to at least be pretty working class,
yeah,
blue
yeah,
collar.
Yeah. So, you know, we have stabbings, is how we used to put it. No, I'm just kidding. I've lived everywhere. I just have a love affair with the city, and it's a true love affair. I think it's a mature love affair, in that I see it warts and all. I'm not a cheerleader for Boston, but I'm very much in love with Boston.
You've said that your portrayal of Boston is accurate for the Boston that you know. Mm-hmm. How would you describe the Boston you know?
I know the Boston at the end of the day. I know the Boston of the city, I think, more than anything. I'm not sure I know the bedroom communities really well. I'm not sure I understand, even though now I've entered a different economic class, and I get that. When people say, well, why don't you write about people of your supposed class? Well, no, it's a bank account. It's not necessarily a class issue. I'm still very in my head back in that other class.
And your father was a union foreman at Sears Roebuck.
Yeah. Yeah. In the Fenway. Yeah.
You said somewhere that your heart is with the working class.
Mm-hmm.
But you've also said that doesn't make you a knee-jerk supporter of all cops and all poor people and all factory workers.
Yeah, no, I don't buy into this. God knows I'm not going to buy into this alleged populist rage that's out there, which I find in a lot of ways idiotic and fueled by big money. Just because you're working class does not make you more honorable than anybody else. What it does very much does not make you is less honorable than anybody else or less deserving than anybody else of anything that this society can give you. So no, I believe that very much to my core. And Eugene Debs had a line, you know, where there is a working class, I am of it, you know, and I just feel that. And I don't feel it in what a heroic great guy I am. I just feel it in, I can't shake it. I can't lose it. I try. Sometimes, you know, I'd really like to feel like I fit in at that golf club, but I don't. I'm always the guy who I'm going to bump into the chair. I'm going to knock a glass off. It's just one of those things. It's be with me for the rest of my life. I just won't quite fit there, even if I'm wearing the suit and the tails and the whatever.
Many of your books have had two lives, mm-hmm. one on paper and
yeah.
another one on the screen.
Yeah.
One of the most talked about remakes, of course, was Mystic River. This is the story about the murder of a woman and then the paths that the police and her own father take to try to find her. Let's listen to a clip of the dialogue between Sean Penn, who plays the father, and Tim Robbins, who plays the father's friend, Dave.
And there's one thing you could say about Katie, even when she was little. That girl was neat. When I got out of the joint, you know, after Rita died, I remember I was more afraid of my little daughter than I ever was of being in prison.
Sean Penn and Tim Robbins, I believe, both won Oscars for their roles in that
yes.
movie.
Yes.
What is the experience like for you of sitting in the movie theater and seeing your work adapted in that way, your characters played by people that you may not have envisioned when you wrote the book?
Oh, it's strange. It's so strange. It's an alterna universe. That's the only way I can put it. And I can love that alternate universe, truly love it, as I do in all three. I love all three of my films. I think they're terrific movies. but they're not the books, and they're not what was in my head specifically. That character is in my head as my guy.
You've said that you won't adapt your own novels for the screen because, mm-hmm. and I think you put it this way once, you said, I don't like operating on my own child.
Yeah, I'm not to be trusted.
But how much creative control do you have, if any, when one of your works is taken and put on the big screen, even if you haven't written the adaptation?
I have control right up until the moment I sell. You know, I hate to put it in really pejorative terms, but it's kind of like a woman on a date. You have control right up until the moment you take your clothes off, you know what I mean? And you still have a little bit of control still left, so you have more control than the guy who just sold his book to the movies, trust me. Once you sell your book, once you say, this is yours, you've ceded all control. It is gone. So my thing is don't sell. Absolutely do not sell until you're sure you're in bed with the absolute best people. And then put your faith in them. And then give me a call if you think of it. And if they want to, they do. And if they don't, I'm totally cool with it. That's not disingenuous. That's not rationalizing. Nothing. Let the artists do their art.
Your interpretation of Boston gets circulated around the world
when your books
get made into movies.
Chamber of Commerce loves me. Yeah.
But of course, Boston is a popular setting for many movies, mm-hmm. and so the city gets portrayed in different ways by different people.
Yes.
Here's a clip of John Hamm of Mad Men fame talking to Ben Affleck in the movie The Town.
You and your boys didn't just roll a Star Market over in Malden for a box of quarters. No, you decided to bang it out in the North End at 9 o'clock in the morning with assault rifles. You dummies shot a guard. Now you're like a half-off sale at Big and Tall. Every cop is in line. Fortunately, though, for you, this guard has miraculously clung to life. Now, if it were up to me, and they gave me 2 minutes and a wet towel, I would personally asphyxiate this half-wit so we could string you up on a federal M1 and end this story with a bag on your head and a paralyzing agent running through your veins.
Super brief plot overview. The Town is about four friends from Charlestown who commit a string of bank robberies. Mm-hmm. Did you see it? And if you saw it, what did you think?
I loved it. I saw it and I loved it. I thought it was so great. I think that Ben Affleck and I have a little bit of prejudice involved here, but I think he is just to the director's chair born. This is what he was meant to do. He is so good as a director. And he puts Boston on the screen in a way that the only film that's comparable in terms of feeling truly Boston, as authentically Boston, is The Friends of Eddie Coyle, which is over 30 years old. So I love that film. And I love the book it's based on, Chuck Hogan's Prince of Thieves. It's a terrific book. And I'm a homer for that movie. I had a blast watching that.
What about the accents? Kind of cringing accents in there.
I didn't think they were too bad at all.
You thought they captured it.
I'll take one for the team right here. Mystic River has bad accents. and that's okay. Mystic River has bad accents. I think The Town, I thought they were pretty spot on. Here's I think a very illustrative moment for a Bostonian. I was watching a documentary on Boston once, and it was on the background. I remember just ironing some clothes, and there was this woman, and she was talking. She was a federal prosecutor from Boston, and she was talking, and I said, "Oh, geez, she's really overdoing the accent." And then I realized, no, she's real. You know
what
I mean?
From here.
This is not a movie. This is a documentary. So sometimes you hear it and you go, oh, we don't sound that bad, do we? No kid, we do, you know?
Here's an even more recent hit that centers around Cambridge.
Who are you?
I'm Marilyn Delpy. I introduced myself when we first...
I mean, what do you do?
I'm a second-year associate at the firm. My boss wanted me to sit in on the deposition phase. What are you doing?
Checking in to see how it's going in Bosnia.
Bosnia. They don't have roads, but they have Facebook.
That's a clip from The Social Network.
I just saw it last night, yeah.
So does that world feel like the world of Boston, Cambridge, Harvard that you know?
Yes. Yes, it does. It feels... and that's the thing. I mean, I think that... I resent when somebody tries to say, you're pigeonholing Boston. No, you're pigeonholing me as pigeonholing Boston. I'm writing about a segment of Boston. And it's a segment I understand, and I have fun with it. And it's a world that I want to write about. Then you have The Social Network, which is an absolutely brilliant movie, probably the best movie of the year. And it's about a different Boston. And you can have movies set in Wellesley. You can have movies set all over the state. And they are all different interpretations of this wonderful thing we call the Commonwealth. And I think there's plenty of room under the tent. It's not a zero-sum game.
Many people have asked you over the years about the writing process.
Mm-hmm.
What I love about the answer that I've read that you give is that you say it's a messy, painful process, but if you don't love it, you shouldn't do it.
Don't do it. Don't do it. There's so many easier ways to make money. This is the old line. This is what I was told when I was 19 years old. If you can stop, stop. Seriously, why go through it? There's no badge of honor for it. If you can't stop, and most people don't get paid. You don't make any money. I mean, I am the exception that absolutely proves the rule. It's a recipe for disaster. It's a profession for sadomasochists. If you're any good, you'll never be happy. I mean, people will talk to me about this, say, oh, which of your books are you proudest of? None of them. I want them all back. I think they all suck. On some level, there's a part of me that just says, give me every single one back because I'm a lunatic perfectionist. I don't know why people would do this except that they can't not do it, and I can't not do it. If I go more than 4 days, I would say, without writing, I begin to lose my identity. If I go 14 days, I'm miserable. I'm a miserable human being to be anywhere near. I need to be scribbling. I need to be thinking about plots. And here's the other thing that most writers, aspiring writers, don't understand. When I say that, that's not writing stuff that's going to be published. That's just writing. The vast majority of things that I come up with, the ideas that I come up with, don't work. They don't pan out.
You just need to get it out.
I just need to try it and see if it works, and then you realize, no, that's a bad idea. Here's the last piece of advice I always give to aspiring writers. If you have the idea that nobody's ever thought of, and you say, this is the greatest idea of all time, I can't believe nobody's ever thought of it, somebody has thought of it. There's a reason they didn't publish it.
Dennis Lehane, thanks for coming on Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
Dennis Lehane is the author of numerous books, and his latest is Moonlight Mile. Up next, a prison librarian gets mugged on the way home from work. Ironic? He thinks so. That's after the break. Stay with us. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. This is Radio Boston.